We think of dictionaries as books of words, but as our linguist Jeff Nunberg observes, the pictures matter too.
Many years ago, someone passed on to me a 7-volume set of the 1907 Grand Larousse Dictionary. The books are all pretty tattered by now, but they're still glorious with their dark red covers embossed with trees and gold letters, their Art Nouveau frontispieces and letter pages, and above all, their intricate engravings and maps and resplendent color plates, plates of animals, birds, and insects, plates of costumes and furniture, and lots of plates of military uniforms. That's the same dictionary that Jean-Paul Sartre recounts reading as a child in his autobiographical novel, The Words. "The Grand Larousse was everything to me," he writes. "I would take down a volume at random behind the desk on the next-to-last shelf. Each volume seemed to denote a different department of universal knowledge. There was the C through D region, the P through Z region, each with its flora and fauna, its cities, its great men, and its battles. Men and beasts were there in person, the engravings were their bodies, the texts was their souls, their unique essences." That's not an experience a child is likely to have nowadays. Whatever virtues most of our dictionaries have, they aren't books to take us lands away. They may include a handful of color plates, but they're basically textual affairs. The illustrations serve mostly to break the unrelieved monotony of the columns of type. Still, those dictionaries do have their visual charms. And it was nice to see a piece in the Sunday New York Times magazine the other day on Jeffrey Middleton, who's the illustrator of the new 11th edition of Merriam-Webster's Collegiate. Middleton is responsible for the elegant little pen and ink drawings inserted every couple of pages or so alongside the entries. It's a style that hasn't much changed in the past 75 years. Dictionary traditionalists argue that those drawings do a better job of rendering the idea of a word than elaborate plates or photographs could. As the American lexicographer Sidney Landau once put it, "Photographs are necessarily of unidealized individual things, whereas drawings can represent a composite distillation." That says as much about the popular conception of photography as it does about dictionaries. It's a fair bet that Pierre Larousse would have used photographs in his grand dictionary if he'd had the technology to print them properly. In that age, people didn't have any problem thinking of photographs as the representations of abstract ideas or imaginary settings. Victorian photographers like Fallon Horne and Henry Peach Robinson produced staged allegories and dramatic scenes with titles like Youth and Age or The Two Ways of Life. Julia Cameron did photographic illustrations for Tennyson's The Idylls of the King, and Henry James allowed the use of photographs to illustrate a 1909 edition of The Golden Bowl. It wasn't until the early 20th century that people began to think of photography as a pure record of the concrete facts before the lens. For Paul Strand, André Kertész, or Henri Cartier-Bresson, there could be no photographs but of things. As Strand once said, "The camera machine cannot evade the objects that are in front of it." Within a few decades, the idea of photographing abstract ideas brought to mind the kitschy propaganda photos that the Nazis and Soviets made with titles like Sunday Volunteers or The Next Generation. And modernist might allow you to make a film of a novel, but you couldn't use stills from it as illustrations when the book was reissued. And even today, no American dictionary uses photographs to illustrate the meanings of words apart from the American Heritage. I should say that I'm associated with that dictionary, though they keep me pretty far from the art department end of things. Yet contemporary photographers put those austere modernist scruples behind them some time ago. Fabulists like Joel Peter Witkin, surrealists like Sandy Skoglund, narrative photographers like Tina Barney or Sam Taylor Wood, all of them take the object in front of the lens as standing in for something other than itself. I like to imagine some avant-garde Grand Larousse of the far future that's illustrated with modern photographs like Cindy Sherman's depictions of herself in the guise of a housewife or a Raphael, or the photographs that Laurie Simmons calls food, clothing, and shelter, where figurines of leggy women wear hot dogs, gloves, and houses on their upper bodies like the dancing cigarette packs in the old gold commercials of the 50s. But the problem with the way most modern dictionaries are illustrated isn't what they imply about photography, but what they imply about words. They leave you with the impression that words are these colorless abstractions at an eternal remove from the concrete realm of the senses. You think of the angels in Wim Wenders' film Wings of Desire, who float in black and white above the streets of Berlin and never make contact with sensory experience. But when you hear words like bagel or bullfrog, what comes to mind isn't a sketchy silhouette. Meanings are part of the world, too, and they have color and texture and form just like everything else. You can even take pictures of them.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University's Center for the Study of Language and Information, and he's the author of The Way We Talk Now.